From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Michigan pauses use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
I've heard concern from health officials who are really worried that people are going to hear about this and they're going to think that the vaccines aren't safe.
We'll talk about what this will mean for the state's plan to vaccinate its way out of the surge. Also, Congressman Dan Kildee talks about seeking help for PTSD symptoms after the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol.
Someone just got killed right in front of us. We didn't know if this was the end of it, the beginning, or what.
And award-winning poet Tommy Blount reflects on exploring the nuances of love and pain for Black Americans.
When I'm writing, I'm drafting it so that that person that's on the page is alien to me, yet it is me, right?
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th left many lawmakers rattled, including Michigan Congressman Dan Kildee.
You know, in my line of work, we're sort of trained to present as if everything's fine because people expect us just to be bulletproof.
We'll speak with Kildee today about why he's speaking out about his experiences seeking treatment for PTSD. That's later in the program, but first, Michigan is hitting pause on use of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine after the company made a disclosure of the nearly 7 million people who've received doses of the vaccine. Six women have experienced blood clots, and one of those six died as a result. The story has complicated the picture for a state that's doing its best to vaccinate its way out of the latest COVID surge. Kristen Jordan Seamus has been reporting on the pandemic for the Detroit Free Press. She joins us now. Hey, Kristen.
It's great to talk to you.
Were you surprised at the news when you woke up this morning and read that the FDA was pausing Johnson & Johnson?
I sure was. I had my alarm set to get my kids ready for school, and I always check online to see what's happening right when I wake up, and sure enough, I saw a headline that said that Johnson & Johnson vaccines were being paused or recommended to be paused. And so I immediately stopped getting my kids ready for school and started going to work.
Looking back at the headlines, though, there were rumblings 3 weeks ago that the Biden administration didn't think Johnson & Johnson could deliver the number of doses it promised. There were problems with one of the company's suppliers. Do you think anyone in the public health infrastructure saw this coming?
It's probably something they've been watching for. I mean, we've seen reports of blood clots in the AstraZeneca vaccine administration happening in Canada and in Europe right now. And both of those vaccines use the same platform. It's an adenovirus recombinant vector vaccine. I don't know if there's a surprise, but I do think that it's something that they were keeping their eye on.
Let's put this into context. The risk of blood clots if a person is taking birth control pills is 1 in 1,000. And we consider that a low-risk side effect when it's prescribed. But the risk for blood clots from the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is 1 in 1 million. Why then do you think health officials had the reaction that they did to this?
I think a lot of it has to do with wanting to be completely transparent. There's a lot of concern that these vaccines came together very quickly, and people are worried in the U.S. and around the world about whether they're safe. And so I think this is just a step that they're taking to be completely transparent, to investigate it, and to make sure that it's okay to continue with these vaccines in the United States.
What do we know about the six women who developed these blood clots?
So we know that all six occurred in women, first of all, and they were between the ages of 18 and 48. And we also know that they developed these blood clots 6 to 13 days after vaccination. So what they're saying right now is if you recently got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and you got it within 3 weeks from today, to be watching out for these symptoms, it's extremely unlikely. I mean, so incredibly rare that you're going to develop any symptoms of this. But they're saying that doctors need to be alert for it, that people who got the vaccine need to be watching for it. That's what we know right now.
Michigan was just beginning its rollout of the Johnson & Johnson vaccination, which I feel like already had this moment in Detroit when Mayor Mike Duggan said over the winter that he didn't want this vaccine used in the city, although in the moment he backtracked on that. First of all, I wonder, have you seen any comment from Mike Duggan today? And I wonder what this is going to do for people who maybe heard that and felt some hesitancy.
I haven't seen any statements from Mike Duggan today. I will say, though, that the city is also pausing the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine following the recommendations of the federal government and the state government.
You know, I keep seeing institutions saying that they're pausing Johnson & Johnson vaccine use and they're switching to some other brands for the doses that they are giving out. Do you know if there's enough supply in Michigan of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines to keep up with the demand with this change?
So for some places, they do have enough to administer Pfizer or Moderna vaccines instead for the appointments that they have already scheduled for this week. But in other places, they don't. So in Washtenaw County, for example, a couple of vaccine clinics have been canceled or postponed for this week. I know the city of Warren had a vaccine fair planned for this week, and they're also canceling it because they don't have enough of the other two types of vaccines to fill in the gap.
Kristen, I seem to remember that you yourself were a part of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine trial back in November. Do you have any concerns about your own health?
Not at all. I don't have any concerns at all about my own health. When you think about the fact that millions of people have gotten this Johnson & Johnson vaccine around the country and around the world, and we've got a report of 6 in the U.S. with these blood clots, it just tells you how very small and minuscule the chances are that you'll have this problem.
Can you remind us what the FDA is saying that people should keep their eye out for if they did get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine recently? What symptoms might people be aware of?
What they're saying to watch for is a severe headache. You know, not just like a little bit of a headache, which is pretty common after you get a Johnson & Johnson vaccine or really any COVID vaccine. You really watch for that severe headache, for abdominal pain or leg pain or shortness of breath. I also interviewed a specialist over at the University of Michigan this morning, and he was telling me that really the window that you want to be watching for symptoms is 4 days post-vaccination to 3 weeks post-vaccination. So if you had a shot yesterday or Sunday or, Saturday, he said, you might have a headache. You might feel achy and have flu symptoms, and that's normal. But it's when you have a severe headache starting after day 4 post-vaccine, that's when you might want to ask your doctor or go to the hospital and get evaluated.
Have you been aware of any problem cases of Johnson & Johnson vaccines in Michigan?
No, I'm not aware of any cases in Michigan. The New York Times reported that one of the women who were affected by this lives in Nebraska, and she is hospitalized and in critical condition. And then there was one death reported as well, but I'm not aware of where that person was from.
Well, if we can just pull back and look at the bigger picture for a minute, what do you think this is going to mean for vaccination rates in Michigan? It feels like we were at this point where the state wanted to start addressing hesitancy in a pretty serious way, wanted to have people talk to their doctors about why it's important to get a vaccine dose. And I got the sense listening to the governor and to the state's chief medical executive, Dr. Joan A. Khaldun, that they didn't feel like we were there yet in terms of vaccinations. Do you think that the overall pace is going to slow down?
I hope not. I don't really know what will happen as a result of this. There is a lot of concern about that. I've heard concern from health officials, from doctors, even from some politicians who are really worried that people are going to hear about this and they're going to think that the vaccines aren't safe. The doctor that I spoke with from U of M this morning said it's extremely unlikely that this is going to be a common event that people will experience from getting a vaccine. You know, he said the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines don't have any association whatsoever with these blood clots. Right now, it's just the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Of course, the most important health risk out there right now is COVID-19.
Knowing what you know about the sense of urgency that brought us to 3 novel vaccines in such a short period, do you think that there is a chance that Johnson & Johnson's use will come back online, or is it essentially done at this point?
The FDA is saying this will be a temporary pause. You know, at a news conference this morning, both FDA and CDC leaders said that they're expecting this pause to last potentially days. This isn't going to be a long, drawn-out investigation. It will be thorough. It'll be complete. But they're saying they don't expect it to drag on or continue for a very long time. So it is likely that we will see this vaccine back in use again relatively quickly. The question is whether the CDC's committee will say, we're recommending it for men only because we've seen these blood clots in women, or we're recommending it only for older women. It's hard to say where they'll go with their recommendations after their investigation, but that's certainly something to watch for.
Kristen, you've been on the health beat prior to the pandemic, and I know you know a little bit about vaccinations and the way that public health officials talk about risk. Do you have any thoughts on the way we've been talking about risk with respect to COVID, and whether the way that people understand risk in the context of a risk of getting COVID versus a risk posed by a vaccination, does that feel very imbalanced to you right now?
It really does. I think, you know, the risk of getting COVID and having a severe illness from it, ending up being hospitalized or ending up dying, is far higher than having a problem with a COVID-19 vaccine. And that's what all the doctors and all the health officials out there are really saying. And that's especially true if you have a comorbidity, if you've got a chronic underlying condition, which the majority of Americans have. If you're considered overweight or obese, that's a complication that could land you in the hospital or kill you if you get COVID. If you have diabetes, if you have high blood pressure, which I think the estimate in the U.S. right now is 45% of Americans have high blood pressure, then you're going to probably have a more severe illness if you were to catch COVID. 45% of Americans, right? If you think about that, and then you think about this very tiny number of women, 6 women out of nearly 7 million who've gotten a Johnson & Johnson vaccine, developed a blood clot. It kind of gives you a better perspective of just how serious this is and how we really ought to be framing it when we talk about vaccine safety.
Kristen Jordan-Shamus covers health and gender for the Detroit Free Press. Kristen, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, April.
After a quick break, Detroit native Tommy Blount's poetry mines the nuances of what it means to be Black and queer in America today. We'll hear about his new poetry collection, Fantasia for the Man in Blue. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Some poets can deliver you images as immediate as a freshly snapped Polaroid. Others work up something more like a meticulously composed oil painting. The Detroit-born poet Tommy Blount's writing belongs somewhere in the realm of short films. They leave devastating scenes in your head for weeks after you read them. The voices in these poems are fearless. They're not shy about human vulnerability, whether the threat is coming from a fist or from something much more intimate. Tommy Blount's recent poetry collection, Fantasia for the Man in Blue, presents the head-on collisions of one queer Black American's experiences with the mythos of white America. The book was a finalist for this year's National Book Award for Poetry, and it is a pleasure to welcome Tommy Blount with us today from his home in the metro area. Tommy, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, April, for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Can we start with a reading?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, Fantasia for the Man in Blue is a poem that recurs several times through the collection, and I wondered if you would read the first version of it for us.
Absolutely. Fantasia for the Man in Blue. You know good and well you can't be out here in the dark morning to take in the moon. Full as the bowl of light attached to this police cruiser. Like a grayed elephant shoots air through its trunk before it charges off to safety from a mouse in one of those old black and white cartoons, you shriek in a debutante's pitch, even though there are reports you are as large as an elephant. Car thefts in the area. The man in blue explains after he asks, where do you think you're going? It's unusual to see your kind walking at this hour. You're an elephant, who's really just a man sweating away in a mascot's costume. You mumble an address. You fumble for an address that isn't your address, but mine. Oh, you've done it now. Don't say anything else. Let me take over this body, soften what letters will bend. I am a poet after all. Don't worry. You'll see. He'll wish us a good morning and let us go after he bends us over the black hood.
That's amazing. And really just the point of departure for the themes that you're dealing with in as this poem recurs over the course of the collection. The threat is so front and center, the physical threat to black protagonists and black lives. And yet the verse is still at the same time so matter of fact about how common it is. I wanted to ask you what it was like to try to hit the balance between communicating the mundanity of the threat for black readers who certainly don't need to be reminded of this, and also to the white readers who might benefit from a shock remembering it.
I guess I should answer this question this way, because I don't really think about, at least when I'm writing poems, I don't think overtly about audience in like an obvious way. So when I'm writing, I'm thinking about what serves the poem first, right? And I'm also thinking about, because this poem and many of my poems begin with some germ of biography or an event that has happened to me, I'm always trying to write towards a kind of alien self, if that makes sense. So when I'm writing, I'm drafting it so that that person that's on the page is alien to me, yet they are me, yet they, you know, they it is me, right? Mm-hmm. I am thinking about audience eventually, right? Because there's going to be some stranger who is going to come into this poem and enter into this poem. Which is why I write towards that alien self, to sort of crack open the eye, which is what I, you know, always, most of my poems are written in first person singular, but I'm always trying to figure out ways to complicate that and crack it open so that whoever comes to the poem steps into it, which is why that you comes in, right? That you, it's actually a pronoun that I use many times in the book, mm-hmm. To sort of be both implication of the reader, but yes, it's also, as creator of this, I'm also implicating myself in this, in these situations.
It's so great how it works, because using both you and I there, it kind of works as that invitation, maybe also mm-hmm. a summons to witness, while evoking mm-hmm. that very casual feeling of two friends or lovers on a walk together.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. There are several poems in the book talking about the dangers to black people, and especially black queer people in the narratives of white America. There's another poem in the book called Late Show at the Americana that is in the voice of a police officer, and a white police officer who's reminiscing about a golden age of America and a golden age of American cinema. And he's kind of calling back for a time when he feels like narratives were so tightly controlled and there wasn't confusion. And it sounds like he feels like he's losing control that he's maintained. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's an interesting line between the storytelling that we do in pop culture, all the stuff we see in the movies, and how those stories mm-hmm. might be important for people who are in power. Were there stories like that that had an effect on you as a younger person?
I'm actually thinking about like just growing up black and queer in Detroit, which is, in the 80s and being a teen in the 90s there. and thinking about how conservative Detroit is, it's still I still see it as very much conservative, not in a sort of political way, but I mean sort of moralistically, especially around in the Black neighborhoods and Black family that I grew up in. And so, you know, I grew up closeted, right? And I often would, I think this is the same for a lot of queer people I'm hearing, that we sort of built little nests for ourselves, especially in the 80s. I remember doing this. I would just grab bits and pieces of like characters from movies and storylines from movies. I remember watching Hairspray, the original Hairspray, John Waters. You know, I was like 7 and 8. I had no business watching John Waters, but my but I grew up in a household that that had cable. We had cable in, I think we got it in like 86 or something like that. But like, I remember watching Hairspray, John Waters, and remember identifying with Tracy Turnblad, you know, Ricky Lake as Tracy Turnblad, because she was, she was wooing, the male co-star who looked like Elvis for some reason. And so little stories like that, like latching on to them and not really seeing like Black queer people. I remember the character Kid from Kids Incorporated was played by the singer Rahsaan Patterson. I remember being drawn to that character.
There's a really funny and poignant poem in the book about you watching the movie Fame and falling hard for, yes, Leroy, one of the dancers.
Yes. That was going to be my next anecdote. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because I think that even though Leroy was presented as this sort of like street, you know, Black street smart kid, you know, but there was something in me that recognized, even at like 8, you know, there was something in me that recognized the queerness of him, right? And the queerness of that character. And so that character, and Gene Anthony Ray, who's the actor who played him, sadly passed away, I think from complications from AIDS. Mm. But that's one character I often think about among the many constellations of figures. I call them my sort of saints that I call on.
Were the people around you recognizing what you were discovering about yourself at this time?
Oh no. Or at least okay, I take that back, because there was a lot, I think, yeah, there definitely was some recognition, because there was a lot of name calling, a lot of, you know, oh, you're Tinkerbell, or you're Sissy, or you know, you're the F word, right? Mm-hmm. So there was some recognition that I was other. I can even remember, you know, being sort of not scolded, but teased because of the way that I talk. Because even then, you know, I was pulling from all of these different places, like, you know, film and TV. And so I'd had this like incredible for like a 9-year-old syntax or whatever that didn't sound like anyone else, you know, in the family. And so that kind of otherness, because it could not be named, or they perhaps didn't want to name it, was kind of, you know, teased. And this is like a, you know, common story, I think, with a lot of queer people. But yeah, and so my whole thing was, the way that I put it is sort of tempering the music of how I spoke and trying in order to harmonize with, you know, everyone around me, which is how I still think about music and poetry that way. It's a kind of pragmatic thing for my speakers to get them through the moment. Mm-hmm. And so it's not just, you know, a melodious thing that sort of makes the sweetness that makes the bitterness go down in the poem, but it's also a pragmatic thing. Like in the poem Phonophobia in the book, where it's actually, that title is actually like a real phobia of mine, which is how it started.
Well,
but
it's
like a real phobia.
Just to explain to people, this is a sort of about a conversation that you used to have with your brother about a situation that he remembered and you did not.
Right. And it's a strange little poem, but that poem is the secondary structure of that poem is all about sound and sonics, and the poem sort of grapples with finding a silence, and by the end it finds a kind of silence that we probably didn't want to find.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is poet Tommy Blount. His recently published collection of poems is called Fantasia for the Man in Blue, and it was a finalist for this year's National Book Award. You invoke a lot of things in the poems in this book that I don't know how this reads for people who've never been to Detroit, but there are things and places in here that Detroiters will recognize. Palmer Park, the big Kehinde Wiley portrait at the Detroit Institute of Arts. And going through the poems, there's also this invitation to see these things which may be familiar through a lens of queerness. So first of all, thank you for that.
Great.
And you talk at one point about how Palmer Park has historically been a place where queer folks go to be together before there were safe places to go, and that the park itself was not always safe. Are there things that you think are important to memorialize or to remember about a place like that?
Yes, absolutely. I think, well, first of all, thank you for noticing. I call that my ghost map in the book of Detroit. Again, it's that kind, it's that thing I was talking about of in a way it's complicating the eye because I am from this place, yet I use it so that it sort of cracks open and gives the reader an entry point. But yes, I do think the older I'm getting, I mean, I'm not that old, I'm 41, but the more that I am lamenting these sort of, not just queer spaces, but spaces in general, like the high school that I went to, Detroit Refford High School, it's a mire now, And then, you know, the neighborhood that I grew up in does not look like the neighborhood that I left. And certainly, places and queer spaces are definitely important to not just remember them, but to perpetuate their power, like to use them and to utilize them. And because history too is tied into that, and stories are also tied into those spaces. And with any lineage, you know, you want to pass that information along so that not only just things are not forgotten or places are not forgotten, but old problems that have been, you know, that had solutions, they always come back, you know, and we have. And when we know what has happened in the past, I hope that we can use that to solve what's happening in the now.
Well, yeah. When I say your writing is fearless, I feel like I kind of know everything that looks fearless is actually a study is in figuring out how to work with fear. or work around
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
I just really wanted to thank you for everything in this collection. And we're looking forward to talking with you again.
Thank you so much, April. This has been fantastic.
Tommy Blount is a poet. His latest collection, Fantasia for the Man in Blue, was a finalist for the National Book Award 2020 for poetry. It's currently available from Four Way Books. Coming up, we'll speak with Congressman Dan Kildee about getting professional help for PTSD symptoms he developed after the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol.
It immediately occurred to me when I heard my wife's voice that, wow, am I having that call? You know, is this that call that we hear about, the call from the burning building or the plane or whatever? And I don't mean to over-dramatize it, but we didn't know what was going to happen.
Plus, we'll hear more about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine pause from a Michigan epidemiologist. That's in just a moment. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm April Baer. The past year and a half has been downright brutal for many of us. That's true for some more than others, as we grapple with the effects of deaths in the family and in our communities, job loss, family hardships of other kinds. And then there are the public traumas, things that we have shared with others. Michigan Congressman Dan Kildee recently revealed that he's been feeling the psychological effects of something that happened to him and hundreds of others who work at the nation's capital, something that happened on January 6th of this year. He's agreed to join us to talk more about that today and about the reckoning that so many are going through. Dan Kildee, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me on, April. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You recently divulged that you've been seeking help for PTSD related to what happened at the nation's capital during the January 6th insurrection. I remember speaking to you after that, and you didn't I wouldn't have said you sounded traumatized. I remember you sounding very angry after that happened. Can I ask what changed and why you decided to seek help?
Well, even during that period, I was dealing with PTSD, you know, but that's the thing about this. And I think that's one of the issues that I think need to be addressed is that people who are struggling with trauma very often present as if everything's fine. And especially, you know, in my line of work, we're sort of trained to present as if everything's fine because people expect us just to be bulletproof. But it was tough. I mean, it was tough for several weeks for me after I got home, after the attack, and began to experience these symptoms. It was pretty obvious to me something wasn't right. And I'm just glad that I was, you know, sort of able to get connected with a professional who has a deep experience in trauma, and it's made all the difference for me.
What does PTSD look like for you?
Well, for me, it, you know, I suppose it's different for everybody, but the symptoms that I had were typical symptoms for somebody dealing with a single traumatic event. I was triggered by the videos and the reporting on the event. I had a high state of agitation. I still remember, you know, the attack was on a Wednesday. I flew home on Thursday. And that Friday, I couldn't sit still in my house. I didn't sit in one spot for more than a few minutes. I was just up moving around, highly agitated state, very irritable, which for me is just not my personality. I had some sort of tightness in my chest. I had a difficult time relaxing, a difficult time thinking clearly. And it was just obvious to me that there was something going on. And so I reached out, was able to get some help. And the most important thing for me was beginning to understand that what I was experiencing, that what's called hypervigilance, anxiety, agitation, irritation, irritability, are pretty typical responses to a single event of trauma. And the delayed reaction is pretty typical as well. So it helped just to hear from a professional that, yeah, this is a highly predictable sort of reaction, and what I was going through was completely normal. Getting through it was important.
Are there lingering memories or feelings or images that have been particularly difficult?
Yeah, there's a sort of a moment more than an image. And it was, actually part of it was captured on video that I shot that was used in the impeachment trial. But it was when I was in the gallery, trapped with a handful of other members after the Capitol had been evacuated. We were really trapped. We were stuck in the gallery of the House because that's where we were listening to the debate just because of COVID. We wanted to get separation. And after the gunshot went off that killed the rioter, things got real serious. And it was obvious that we were, you know, dramatically outnumbered by the attackers and the few police officers that were with us. And I called my wife, just like almost all my colleagues did. They called their spouse or their loved one to say what's going on. And, you know, that call, it immediately occurred to me when I heard my wife's voice that, wow, am I having that call? You know, is this that call that we hear about, the call from the burning building or the plane or whatever? And I don't mean to over-dramatize it, but we didn't know what was going to happen. Someone just got killed right in front of us. We didn't know if this was the end of it, the beginning, or what. And so that moment was that moment where I sort of came face to face with the reality that I'm not as safe as I thought I was.
What's been helpful as you've been walking yourself back from the edge of it?
I think one is, you know, talking to a mental health professional who specializes in trauma and understanding that what I was experiencing was expected. Understanding, like, for example, just the sort of the fight or flight reaction that we all go through, and that sometimes there's a delayed response to this. Not that I have a difficulty with people who require medication, but I have not needed any medication. I've been able to use breathing techniques, meditation, other techniques that Dr. Jim Gordon, who's the person I've been working with, that he has taught me, has made a real difference in sort of getting myself through this and in many ways feeling better than I did even before the attack. Because let's face it, that was a singular event. But as you said in the lead into this piece, the last year and a half have been really traumatic for all of us. We've lost loved ones. I've lost friends. We've had to totally change our way of life. So the stress that comes with that as a backdrop is also something that these techniques have helped me to deal with. And I feel much more like myself now than I have for a while.
Dan, you come from a part of Michigan where the attitude is sometimes, the attitude can be hard times don't last, hard men do. Why did you decide to speak out about this?
Because I feel like I need to sort of take my own advice. You know, my background, my original career was in dealing in helping to treat traumatized children in an agency for emotionally disturbed, neglected, and abused kids. I was the chair of the Genesee County Community Mental Health Board. I have believed forever that we need to erase the stigma between normal health care and or the stigma that associates with mental health awareness and mental health care. And so for me to seek care, because I absolutely needed it, and to deal with it, I think, in a way that proves its value, I mean, it was worked well for me. I just kind of felt like if I keep this to myself, I'm not really being true to my own word. I've been giving people advice for years to treat the health above the neck the same way you do below the neck. And if I'm not willing to tell my story, it didn't feel like I was being true to myself. And I felt I was obligated to talk about it. You know, one of the points that you make, though, is one of the reasons that there's a stigma is because of the reaction that people have. You know, most of the reaction I've had to telling this story has been very positive, but not all of it. You know, not all of it. There are people out there who are, you know, not enlightened and use this as a way to attack or diminish or minimize or ridicule me. And I was telling my staff earlier today, because they're getting a lot of this incoming, I said, this is exactly why I need to say this. Because this is the reason people don't seek help when they need it. And I can take it. I can take the shots. I'm sort of, you know, conditioned for it as a person who's been in public life my whole adult life. Not everybody can do that. And so I feel like If I can take some of that incoming and open the door for one person to make that phone call, it'll be worth it. Let them attack me, but people need to get the help they need.
Dan Kildee represents Michigan's 5th District. Congressman, thank you so much for joining us and talking about this.
Thank you very much.
We wanted to get back to today's top story. The state of Michigan is halting use of the Johnson & Johnson one-dose COVID-19 vaccine. The FDA recommended this pause, and we know that 6 patients have experienced blood clots out of the nearly 7 million Americans who have received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine so far. How long will the state of Michigan's pause on Johnson & Johnson vaccines last? And how far-reaching will this pause be as public health officials struggle to get COVID under control? With us to talk about some of the decisions under discussion right now is Emily Martin, an associate professor of epidemiology at the University of Michigan. Hey, Emily, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
We already knew that it was a pretty big deal for the FDA to approve emergency use of a vaccine. So how big a deal is it then to put the brakes on that same product?
Well, in essence, this is the system as it's intended to work. You know, these vaccines during this rollout, we're having really unprecedented levels of monitoring, both safety monitoring for big events like this, but then also monitoring for day-to-day side effects as people are getting vaccinated. And so, you know, as part of that kind of contract with the American public, this monitoring comes with the ability to stop and review when we see a safety event like this happen, to kind of evaluate what's behind it. Is this coincidence? Is this related to the vaccine? And that's what we're seeing happen right now.
If we look at these numbers, nearly 7 million people vaccinated with doses made by Johnson & Johnson. And out of those nearly 7 million, 6 cases of blood clots and 1 death. Do you see those as numbers that warrant a pause?
So it's exceedingly rare, as those numbers show. I think, you know, one of the reasons behind the pause, which I think is worth thinking about, is sometimes a pause gives an opportunity for, you know, as the FDA and the CDC learn more over the next couple of days, the guidance that they can issue to advise doctors and healthcare professionals and public health professionals in terms of what to watch for and how to handle a signal if we do see one of these rare events could save, these events from occurring in the future. And so sometimes these pauses are great from an educational reason while they review the safety. And I think there's value in that.
What do you expect that researchers will be trying to find out about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine in the short term?
Usually what happens during this time period is they go deep into the data, all of the safety data they have on all of these different administrations to see if there are other signals that might corroborate what they're seeing. They're also going to go deep into these specific cases and review laboratory data and medical data and look for any sort of connection that they might be able to draw a conclusion from. And so you're going to see this kind of sweep of abroad across all of the vaccinations, but then also this deep dive into the individual cases to try to figure out whether they're going to look to see if there's a biologic mechanism that can speak to what they're seeing. But then also, are there kind of other underlying safety signals in the data that they hadn't picked up yet that will shed any light on this?
Emily, I don't want to seem like I'm putting words in your mouth, but I think I'm hearing you say that the question at this point might not be, is this a safe product? But the question is, what signals might health professionals look for in people who receive the vaccine going forward? Am I reading that right?
That's right. Like, I think what we can expect to hear, and obviously, you know, there's more to learn and we don't want to get out ahead of the reviews as they're happening, but this is an exceedingly rare event. We know that already. And so, you know, what we can expect to hear is guidance around either adjustment of what to watch for when we're looking at adverse events, how to do it even more safely than we are already. And we also might see, you know, some of the things, strategies that we've seen in Europe and other places are kind of tweaking the guidance in terms of who gets what vaccine product to try to optimize things further. You know, I still am impressed by just the millions of people that have already received this vaccine safely.
Do you worry that this pause might have a ripple effect on the pace of vaccinations overall?
Absolutely. I think, you know, just operationally, this is a really critical time to be vaccinating. And so any sort of pauses and switches in strategy that we're seeing even this week, next week, I mean, here in Michigan, it's really important that we keep vaccinating as quickly as possible because we've got such high rates and such widespread COVID happening. In nationally, you know, you can see there's going to be probably a ripple effect just operationally from doing this. But then, you know, for communications, we're going to probably have a few weeks here where we're going to have to have that kind of careful scientific message about what we know, communicating the uncertainty, and then communicating what we learned from the review, and really getting that message out to the American public. And so you can imagine where that's going to be challenging for public health professionals.
Right. I mean, do you think that there is a simple way to communicate that kind of risk? We've been talking and talking and talking about the risks of COVID for well over a year now. This conversation that we've been having about potential risks for people who do take vaccines, I mean, do you think there is a simple and effective way to communicate those relative risks to the public?
It's really hard, you know, and my experience has been before COVID was working a lot with the influenza vaccine, which is a vaccine that doesn't have these like 70%, 90% effectiveness numbers. It's really much more variable from year to year. And what we started doing very frequently is focusing on what we called the averted burden, which is a little bit of a tongue twister, but really focusing on the number of lives that are being saved by the vaccine. And, you know, that number is already climbing higher and higher, the number of deaths that we know that have been prevented to date by the vaccine. And so, you know, that's an important message that we need to remember and not forget, that as we try to prevent these rare events and we take them seriously, we look at them, we also know that we're saving a lot of lives at the same time.
It seems like if there's a really unfortunate juxtaposition here, it's the fact that Michigan is going through such a serious surge in COVID infection rates right now, even as this question about some of the warning signs for Johnson & Johnson vaccines are coming up at the exact same moment.
It's a huge challenge, you know, because right now with the climbing rates, it's really important to vaccinate. And so it's really a challenge to have this hiccup and interruption. I mean, it's not the most common vaccine coming into the UN or into the US, but it is still a major piece of the pie. The other thing is, you know, because this vaccine is one dose, it is really useful to use for people that might be really mobile and might not be someplace where they expect to get, you know, be around 4 weeks later in the same spot to get the same dose. And so it's been a really go-to useful tool, especially as we're looking at younger segments of the population. So I hate to use that tool, or I hate to lose access to that tool. I'd like to continue to be able to use that. And so hopefully this review will help show that it's safe to keep doing so.
Emily Martin, epidemiologist with the University of Michigan. Emily, thanks.
Thank you.
And that's Stateside for today. Our show is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and by our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newhan, Nell Ovid, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back tomorrow.